And things get bad, boy, do they get bad. I. HLB though TNAERNAYB, match, if the Shadow Club, laid low for a while and didn't play any tricks, then Green, might leave us alone. Maybe everything would be alright. But things weren't alright. I had hoped that David Berger's flattened trumpet would be the last of the mysterious pranks, but it was not. Someone was terrorizing the Unbeatables. Someone who didn't care how much the Unbeatables got hurt, or how much property was destroyed, and this person, whoever it was, thought they could get away with it by blaming the Shadow Club. There was only one person who knew enough about the Shadow Club to do that, Tyson McGaw. I say we give him what he deserves, said Randall, as we sat around Stonehenge at our next meeting. Yeah, said Darren. We should beat the daylights out of him and force him to confess. And then get him expelled from school for it, added Jason. Everyone else agreed. And 132 oh,
no,
I said. We have no proof, we can't do anything like that yet. What other proof do we need? Asked Abby. He's the only other one who knows about the club. It has to be him. We can't do anything yet, though, I said. Not until we can prove he's doing the pranks. He's innocent until proven guilty, added Cheryl, even though we know he's guilty. So what do we do? Asked OP. Sit around and wait to be blamed for everything? What if something really bad happens? Don't worry, I said. Tyson's crazy, but not that crazy. Nothing really bad is going to happen. Boy, was I wrong. That next week, the entire club vowed to look out for the Unbeatables. Watching them as well as watching Tyson, too, make sure that no more pranks were pulled. We must have done a lousy job of it though, because on Thursday, during lunch, True Lenders became the next victim. Drew, as I've told you, is a swimmer, and very much into it. In fact, he had this obsession with anything that had to do with swimming. It only made sense, then, that Drew had a thing for fish. For as long as I knew Drew, he had always had a fish tank. It was the one thing in his room that he kept clean, and he had a second tank in school, in Mr. Milburn's D133P room. I guess because he considered himself a human fish, he had a weird sort of affection for his cousins in the tank. Anyway, that 60-gallon tank had sat in Mr. Milburn's classroom since Drew started 7th grade, and now, a year later, it was still there, filled with starfish, sea anemones, and brightly colored saltwater fish. They were pretty, they were expensive, and Drew loved those fish like most normal people might love a pet dog. Every once in a while, some bozo would drop something stupid into the tank, a bar of soap or maybe the shavings from the classroom pencil sharpener. Once, someone put red food coloring in the tank. After Mr. Milburn changed the water, the fish seemed fine, although they were sort of pink for a while. No matter what dumb things kids did to that tank, those fish always seemed to come out of their ordeals all right. But not this time. During lunch, Mr. Milburn always locked his room and went down to the teacher's lounge to fall asleep while listening to the rest of the teacher's gossip. Well, as everyone knows, school classroom locks are the easiest in the world to pick. All you have to do is slide a hanger into the door jamb, and bingo. Well, that's what someone did, and then that same Someone dropped a firecracker into Drew's fish tank. Now, there are firecrackers and there are firecrackers. There are the kind they call safe and sane, and there are T4FA4FVTFUB, N134N, the kind that are more like hand grenades. There are cherry bombs and M80s that, when put in a strategic location, can do an awful lot of damage, but the worst by far are blockbusters. Packed into the cylinder of a blockbuster is a quarter stick of dynamite, and when one goes off, it can be heard for miles. I don't know how they did it, but someone rigged up a blockbuster to go off in that fish tank, and when it blew, nothing in the room was safe. The tank turned into one huge bomb, sending glass and water flying in all directions, shredding plants and tearing paper on the walls. The room became a war zone. I was out on the field with Cheryl and Randall, consoling Randall from his recent humiliation. It seemed that the day before, after swim practice, Drew threw Randall out of the locker room with no clothes on. Almost the second I had convinced Randall it was better to forget about it for a while, we heard the explosion. Boom! It was so loud you'd swear the whole school had blown up. The blast echoed from the high school across the large field, and a strange silence followed. Everyone turned toward the school. "Not again," said Cheryl. At first we all thought this was yet another school fire, but in a moment I began to suspect it was another evil prank. I turned to look for Tyson but couldn't find him, and that sick feeling returned to my stomach, along with the cold feeling to my hands. Meanwhile, several, A135A, teachers ran into the school to evacuate the remaining students. For all they knew, a gas line could have blown up. Someone pulled the fire alarm, and in minutes the fire trucks arrived. It didn't take long for the firemen to find out what had happened. From what I heard, there was nothing left of the fish tank, and the collection of fish that Drew Lenders had spent years putting together was gone in a fiery fraction of a second, and... "Tell me the truth, Randall," said a kid after school. "Cheryl and I were talking before I went off to track practice, and, as usual, Randall was hanging around with us, making obnoxious comments about the fact that we spent so much time together, when this kid, someone on the swim team, I guess, came up to us and asked Randall a question. 'Tell me the truth,' he asked. 'Did you blow up Drew's fish tank?' 'Tell me the truth, I won't tell anyone.'" Randall was speechless. He turned to Cheryl. "See? See, what did I tell you? Just because of what he did to me yesterday, everyone's gonna think that I blew up his tank. I'm being framed," he yelled. Then he turned to the kid. "No! I didn't do it, so just get out of here, all right?" "Yeah, I'll bet you didn't do it," said the kid, and ran off. "You better keep your mouth shut, because I didn't," yelled Randall, as the kid ran away. He turned to me and, A135A, "Cheryl. You know I didn't, right? I was there with you all, during lunch, you know I was. I know, and you know, but who's going to believe us?" "I said." "I see a pattern emerging," said Cheryl. "Have you noticed that these pranks have been pulled soon after the victim has done something really mean to a member of the Shadow Club?" "Huh?" said Randall. "Think about it, Blimp Brain," said Cheryl to her brother. Eric Kilfoyle's locker was filled with paint the day after Darren nearly got into a fight with him, Darren told me about that. David Berger's trumpet got run over the day after David was chosen to play for the high school band again, and he'd made Jason feel miserable about it. Tommy Nichols had just beat out OP for a place in the district science fair before the camera incident, and now Drew's fish tank explodes the day after he threw you out of the locker room naked. Then someone is definitely trying to frame us. Exactly, said Cheryl. And if anyone finds out about the club, then we're going to be the prime suspects. We're the only ones with motives. We're already suspects, I said, because someone already knows about the club. Cheryl and Randall turned to me with that end-of-the-world look in their eyes. Green knows. I don't think he knows what we've done, but he, a 137, knows about the club, and I'm sure he suspects us. Until then, I hadn't told anyone.
How?
Asked Cheryl. Tyson told him. I'm sure of it.
Tyson,
said Randall, with a hiss in his voice that made him sound like a snake. I told you he was behind all this. It has to be, said Cheryl. I'll bet we could prove Tyson blew up the fish tank, said Randall. Fingerprints or something. And then another voice entered the conversation. I saw him do it, said the voice. We all turned around, and standing there, braces, freckles, curly hair, and all, was Ralphie Sherman. You're talking about the fish tank, right? Said Ralphie. Well, I saw Tyson McCall blow it up. We were all quiet. Ralphie blew a big fat bubble gum bubble, and it popped in his face, sticking to his eyebrows. He peeled it off and popped it back into his mouth. It's true, he said. I was in the classroom. I saw. How could you have been in the classroom? You would have been killed by the exploding tank, Cheryl said. Well, not in the classroom, but looking in through the window. I saw Tyson do it. Honest. But I saw you in the field when it went off, Ralphie, said Randall. Darn right, said Ralphie. I wasn't going to hang around if a blockbuster's about to go off. I left as quickly as I could. TJFEJRCV dollar? A 138, we all looked at Ralphie. Ralphie Sherman, who couldn't pass a true or false exam because he didn't know the difference. Should we believe this? Ralphie blew another bubble, this one bigger than his whole head, and when it popped it stuck to his hair. He peeled it away and shoved the gum back into his mouth. You know what? I said. I believe him.
Me too, said Cheryl.
So do I, said Randall. Ralphie's eyes lit up. You do? Really, honestly, truly, you believe me? Yeah, I said. Ralphie smiled and skipped off toward his bus, the happiest boy in the world. We didn't get a moment's rest that day, for only 30 seconds after Ralphie went skipping away, we turned to see a commotion at the school's front gate. Hey, yelled Martin Bricker to anyone who would listen. Vera can't stop her bike, and she's headed toward Cellar Boulevard. Cheryl, Randall, and I raced toward the front gate, but it was too late. As we looked down the street, we could see Vera flying down the hill, screaming at the top of her lungs. Of course, I thought to myself. What an idiot I was. Didn't Abby have a big argument with Vera today? Didn't Vera called her a slob in front of half the grade, or something, D-139-0/, like that? Of course Vera would be the next victim, if Tyson were trying to frame the club. We watched in horror as she crossed through the first intersection on the way to Cellar Boulevard, which was down at the bottom of the hill. Luckily it was a small intersection, and no cars were there at the time. But Cellar Boulevard would be a different story. It was one of the busiest streets in town and I could see cars and buses racing across it. "She's gonna get herself killed," yelled someone from the crowd, as we all watched Vera fly down the street. "Can't somebody stop her?" If she had half a brain, she would have turned and smashed into a fence rather than race across Cellar Boulevard, but as anyone could tell you, Vera Donaldson did not have half a brain. In seconds she came up on Cellar Boulevard and went flying out into the middle of traffic. Car horns blared, a van swerved, a car screeched to a halt and was rear-ended. Vera sailed across the street, hit the curb, and went bouncing off of her bike, hitting her head on a fire hydrant, while the bike went crashing through Muggleson's bakery window, laying the window to waste and demolishing a 5-layer wedding cake on display. Everyone, including Cheryl and Brenda, ran down the street to find out how Vera was, but I didn't. There was someone who I had to find, and I had to find him now. It didn't take long. He was standing by his locker in the main hallway. N-140L, Tyson. I snarled, "You're gonna pay for this." "Get out of my face," he grunted and tried to leave, but I grabbed him by his shirt, and as he struggled, I dragged him through the hall. "Leave me alone, you moron. You idiot. You butthead." I didn't say anything. Not yet. Not until I had him in a place where no one would hear us. I dragged him down the hall and shoved him in the school phone booth, closing the door behind us. He struggled, and I shook him so hard that he began to look like one of those marionettes he had up on his wall. "Listen up, and listen good," I said. "I know what you've been doing, and you're not going to get away with it." "I don't know what you're talking about," he screamed. I put my hand over his mouth so he couldn't scream. He bit it, and I pushed him back so hard that the telephone receiver went flying off the hook. I could hear the dial tone. "If you scream one more time, slimeball, I'm gonna hit you so hard your next of kin will feel it too." That shut him up. I said, "I know what you've been doing. I know you're trying to frame us, and I think it really stinks. I think you stink, slimeball, and I'm telling you right now that if there's one more prank, if another unbeatable gets hurt, you're gonna have all 7 of us in the club coming down on you, so hard you won't know what hit you." "I don't know what you're talking about," he screamed. "O-141, shut up. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You talk green about our club, and now you're trying to get us all in trouble. Why did you tell Green, anyway? Couldn't you have left well enough alone?" "All right," he said. "I admit I told Green, but I didn't do anything else." "Liar," I said. "And I didn't do it to be mean. Now leave me alone." "Then why did you tell him?" "He didn't answer me." "Why did you tell him?" I pushed him. The door to the phone booth flew open, and Tyson flew out, falling to the ground. "Why did you tell him?" I screamed. He didn't answer. He got up and ran down the hall as quickly as he could. I watched him run, brimming with anger. I couldn't remember having ever hated anyone as much. Not even Austin. Then I began to yell, hoping everyone left in school heard me. Bedwetter. I yelled. Bedwetter. Tyson pees in his bed. It echoed through the halls and the sound lingered long after Tyson had burst through the school's front doors. I shouldn't have gone to track practice that day. I should have just run home and buried myself in my homework, or, better yet, buried myself in my pillow and hidden like an us, a 142 a trick until this whole thing passed over. That's what I should have done, but I didn't. Instead, I ran out to the field to be with the track team, and that was a mistake, because, as everyone knows, bad luck comes in threes. First on that fateful day came the fish tank, then Vera's bike, and then came the nastiest run-in I ever had with Austin Pace. By the time I arrived at practice, Austin was leading the stretching exercises, and Coach Schuler was nowhere to be seen. I was about 10 minutes late, and it was never good to be late for practice. Well, looky here, said Austin. The gopher finally decided to show up. Hi, gopher, said Martin Bricker. Kids didn't even say it to be mean anymore. They just said it like it was my name. Give me 20 push-ups for being late, gopher. I dropped and gave him 20. When I was done, Austin had the whole team sit down as he opened the large carton that was on the ground. Here are our team uniforms, he said. Everyone was pleased to hear that, and for a few minutes I was glad I had decided to go to practice that day. Coach Schuler will be out in a minute with the team sweats. Austin opened the box and began to hand them out. Miller, he said, tossing Greg Miller his top and matching shorts. This was the first year that the team actually got new N143N sweats and uniforms that had each kid's name on them. Some said it was because the track team deserved it, but most knew it was because Austin's father had made a big donation to the team. Bricker! Yelled Austin, as he tossed Martin's shirt and shorts to him. I waited patiently, and he finally got around to mine. Mercer, he said, throwing me my uniform. It felt good to hold the brand new uniform of the team. That smooth feel of the light, colorful material, and that new smell it had. It reminded me that our first meet was coming up soon, and I could hardly wait. My times were getting better, and although they weren't quite as fast as Austin's, they were pretty good. Now, to make it complete, I had a uniform with my name on it. I felt like a real runner, and for a minute it made me forget about my other troubles. I couldn't wait to try on the shirt, so although it was a bit chilly, I took off my shirt and was about to try the new one on when I caught a glimpse of the bright red name written across the back. It said Gopher. I sat there for a few moments, letting it sink in. Gopher. My team shirt said Gopher. Austin, I said. TTIIS better not be mine. I threw it back at his face, waiting to see what he would say. He caught it and looked at it. TJ Officia, N144N, nope. Gopher. That's you. He threw it back at me. I clenched my hands into fists and gritted my teeth. It says Gopher? Asked one of the seventh graders. Let me see. He grabbed it and I grabbed it back. My name is Mercer, not Gopher. I threw the shirt at Austin's face again. He caught it. Didn't you want Gopher on your shirt? That's how everyone knows you. He threw it back in my face.
No,
I said. I would never wear it. Never. Well, it's too late, said Austin. The shirts and sweats have already been made up. That's written on my sweats too? Of course. That did it. I dropped the shirt and lunged at him. How could he do that? Not only did he humiliate me, but he was trying to force me to humiliate myself by wearing that word on my shirt. I swung my fist, missing his face by less than an inch. I swung again, but by then a dozen hands were on me, holding me back. Let go of me. I screamed, but the team just held me and wouldn't let me get a clear shot at Austin. I struggled and kicked, but they wouldn't let me go. Look at him, somebody yelled. Heck, fighting like Tyson fights. That only made me struggle harder. Then, out of nowhere, Coach Schuller appeared and pulled me out of the hands of the others, shaking me so hard that my brain rattled. D-145, what do you think you're doing, Jared? Stop it. Stop it, now. My head hurt from the shake-up, and my arms went limp. This is a team, Jared, he said, and you had better remember that. You don't start fights with your team captain. I don't care what your differences are, you don't fight with him. But, did you hear me? I said that you don't fight with Austin. Is that clear? I stood there, catching my breath. I wouldn't give him as much as a nod. He put Gopher on my uniform. The coach turned to Austin, and Austin shrugged. Honest mistake, Austin said. We'll settle this after practice, said the coach. That's when Austin came up to me. Now, come on, said Austin, holding out his hand to shake. Let's forget about this whole thing, all right? I looked at his hand. I have to admit, I almost did it. I thought about shaking Austin's hand and eating my pride for the sake of the team, but then he said, come on, be a good gopher, and forget about it. My hands clenched into fists again. I wouldn't shake his hand after that, I wouldn't even stand in the same field with him. I picked up my backpack, shoved my disgusting gopher shirt into it, and I walked. The coach tried to follow, so I ran. I ran to the edge of the field, and kept running, put a 146-ing as much distance between me and Austin Pace as I could. A moment later I realized that someone was running with me. I saw the whole thing. It was Cheryl. I think it was awful. Austin's a real creep. Great. The last thing I wanted was for Cheryl to see Austin humiliate me. Jared, called the coach, let's talk about this. But I ignored him. What are you doing here, anyway? I asked her. I came to tell you that Vera is all right. She bumped her head, but she'll be all right. It was good to hear, but it didn't make me feel any better. I ducked through a hole in the fence and into the woods. Cheryl followed. I kept running through the trees, getting scratches on my arms from branches, but still that anger wouldn't leave. Jared, slow down, said Cheryl. I can't keep up with you. I stopped. We were far from the field now.
You know what?
I said. I hope Tyson was watching and gets Austin next. I hope Tyson pulls a terrible trick so mean that Austin never gets over it. That's what I hope.
Cheryl looked at me kind of strange.
You really want that, she asked. I thought for a moment, catching my breath. I don't, a 147, know what I want. It was true. I didn't know how I felt, or what I wanted. I didn't even know who to hate anymore. Austin, Tyson, the Shadow Club, or maybe just myself for allowing all this to happen.
Hey, said Cheryl, taking my hand, why don't you say you come over to my house and we make chocolate shakes like we used to?
I put my normal shirt back on and reluctantly said, okay. She put her arms around my neck and kissed me.
Things'll be okay, she said. I wanted to believe it, so I kissed her again.
Then, with my arm around her shoulder, we went off to her house. Used to be, drinking a chocolate shake would make any problem disappear, but even as I sat there in Cheryl's living room, watching TV and filling up on chocolate shakes, I knew that it would take a whole lot more to solve these problems. 2. Morning came after a lousy night of nightmares, dreams about my parents turning into gophers, dreams about being stepped on by a 60-foot-tall Austin Pace in huge white AirPods, dreams about being trapped in a fish tank that was about to explode. Nasty stuff. I woke up with a headache. My parents could tell that something was bugging me, but when they asked what it was, I didn't tell them about the pranks and about Tyson. I simply told them, as I always did, that Austin Pace was the problem.
Him again?
Said my father, before he left for work. Don't worry about him. Austin Paces are a dime a dozen, but there's only one Jared Mercer. He smiled and mussed up my hair with his hand, which one used to like, before I discoffered the importance of the hairbrush. Don't let him get to you, said my mom, which was easy to say, but hard to live by. Dad, I said, as he was about to leave. For a split. TFCEFLOTJ D149D. Second, I felt like telling both of them everything about the Shadow Club, what we did, how we were being framed, everything, but no. What kind of club president would I be if I told my parents? Forget it, I said. See you tonight. My father left, and I went off to school. If I could have told them, it could have ended right there, but I guess I just didn't have sense enough to do that. I had to get sense knocked into me the hard way. As I crossed the field on my way to school that Friday morning, I saw Austin running his morning laps in his AirPods, as he did every stupid little morning of his stupid little life. I wouldn't look at him. I looked up. I looked down, I looked at the grass, the sky, the bleachers, anything but Austin. And, because I was so intent on not looking at him, I ended up tripping over some sharp, jagged rocks sticking out of the ground in the middle of the field. Wonderful, I thought. Now Austin will laugh at me for tripping over my own feet. He didn't, though. He kept on running and ignored me. I got off the field as fast as I could, without making it look like I was hurrying. As I entered the school, it began to hit me that there were only two unbeatables left to be hit by Tyson, Austin, and Rebecca. That's when Cheryl came up to me. There you are, she said. I've been looking all over for TJ if he come. A 150L, you. She looked at my hands.
What happened to
who?
She asked. Slash, I looked at them. They were scratched up a bit from when one had fallen in the field. I tripped. That's all. I've been on Tyson patrol, she said. I think the whole club should take shifts watching him. Where is he? I haven't seen him yet, she said. That's when something clicked inside my head. Something dark and scary began to come into clear focus. It began, slowly. First I looked at my hands again, at the scratches. Those rocks I had tripped over weren't there the day before. They couldn't have been. What were such sharp rocks doing, buried in the middle of the field anyway? The middle of the field. Oh no. Oh no. No slash, Cheryl must have seen it in my eyes. What's the matter? She asked. Austin. I yelled. We have to stop Austin. I turned and ran, sprinting down the hall, knocking down kids and teachers, running at my top speed to the exit. Far behind me, I could hear Cheryl calling my name, but I didn't have time to stop. I may have already been too late. I burst through the double doors, knocking down two kids. Austin. I screamed as I ran, for as well as I knew that those rocks hadn't been there the day before, I also knew that Austin sprinted across the center of the oval field once. And 151-0, every single day, barefoot. Everyone knew he did it, but I was the only one who knew about the rocks. Only I could stop him. I ran out from between the bleachers in time to see Austin race across the grass, barefoot, leaving his AirPods far behind as he headed toward the rocks. Of all of the mixed up feelings inside of me, one thing was certain. I wanted with all my heart to stop Austin from running through that minefield of razor sharp stones. Austin. I screamed. Austin, stop. But he wouldn't. He would never stop in the middle of a race. I ran through the grass to try to catch him, but I wasn't fast enough. I just wasn't fast enough. All I could do was watch as he hit the rocks. First his left foot fell onto them, and it broke his perfect stride. He tried to keep his balance, and that's when his right foot came down on them. He slid, and then an instant later, he was flying through the air, forced head over heels by the tremendous speed of his own body. I went to him and almost had to turn away from what I saw. It was horrible. Austin had hit the worst of the rocks in the worst of ways. The soles of both his feet had been gashed open, and his left foot seemed twisted in a nasty position. Austin saw them and began to scream.
No! No!
My feet! He yelled, my feet, my feet, my feet. Over and over, again. I could see the pain was just beginning to set in. I, D-152-0, knelt before him. There was blood everywhere, and I didn't know what to do. My feet, my feet.
No!
Not my feet. Anything but my feet. I took off my shirt and pressed it against one foot to hold back the bleeding, and he yelled, oh, my ankle. It's broken? My ankle's broken. My ankle. My ankle. I didn't know much about broken ankles, but something definitely did look wrong. His foot was twisted real funny, and whenever I tried to move it, he shrieked. It was beginning to puff up and turn blue.
No!
Not my feet. He cried, My shirt began to turn red. It's all right, I said, even though I knew it wasn't all right. You'll be fine. Then he looked at me, and I'm pretty sure that was the first time he realized it was me helping him. Gopher, he said. My feet. My feet. By now other kids began to gather around, and teachers were running out from the school. Give me a shirt, I demanded, and three kids tossed me their shirts. I pressed one of them to Austin's other foot. My feet, he mumbled, through his tears. You'll be all right.
No.
No, you don't understand. He cried. My father wants me to go to the Olympics. I have to go. He's counting on me. I have to. I have to run. Austin's face was getting ticky, D153D, redder and redder from his tears. I've been training for years. Years. Next year I'm getting a private coach. My feet. I can't run if my feet are, he looked down at them.
No.
What will I do? What will I do? What will I tell my father? He'll kill me. My anklet, it hurts. He'll kill me. What will I do? Austin broke down and just cried like a baby, until it almost made me cry. In a moment, Mr. Diller, our principal, came and carried Austin to the nurse's office. I was about to follow, but first I ran to the tip of the oval, picked up Austin's AirPods, and brought them along. Whatever Austin had done to me in the past, whatever humiliation he had ever rubbed my nose in, he didn't deserve this. He was Olympics bound. Running was his life. It wasn't my life. For me, running was something I could do, that I liked doing, but for Austin, it was even more important. His feet would need stitches, but worse than that, his ankle would take months to heal. Who knew how long it would be till he could run again, if ever. Sure, now I was fastest on the team, but all at once I didn't care anymore. Believe it or not, I cared more about Austin's feet. I followed Austin and Mr. Diller to the nurse's office and watched as they tended to Austin's feet until they shut the door. Still, I could hear his sobs. I stood there for at least 5 minutes without realizing I had no shirt on. My shirt was ruined now, but there was another shirt in my backpack. My T4EJLFI A154N track team gopher shirt. I put it on and sat outside the door. Soon Cheryl showed up, and the nurse suggested that I go to class, but I refused. I let Cheryl go, and I waited. Finally, the nurse let me in the office to keep Austin company while she called his parents. Inside, it smelled like alcohol and blood. Austin's feet were all wrapped up now. The white gauze was the same color as his AirPods. They had splinted the broken one. I still held his AirPods, and I placed them on the chair next to him. Thanks for helping me, Jared, he said, his eyes still a bit wet. I smiled. It was the first time he'd called me Jared all year. It's okay, I said. I'm sorry about what happened. He swallowed. I guess I've been a real snot to you, he said. Yeah, I admitted. It's okay, though. I guess it's because I'm real competitive, you know. My brother says it's good to be competitive. I don't know. I guess all these years you were the only one who came close to being as fast as me. It scared me. It was like if one person could come close to beating me, then I wasn't good enough for the Olympics. He looked at me, and I just listened. I guess we could have been real great friends, he said, if I gave you the chance. I nodded, and Austin looked at his bandaged feet. His eyes began to tear again, and his face turned red. A 155N, I'm never going to the Olympics now, MF. His tears rolled right off his face and onto the gauze. I sat with him until his mother arrived to take him to the hospital. News had spread through the school at light speed, and by the time I got to class, everyone was buzzing about what had happened to Austin. It didn't take long for people to figure out that it wasn't just an accident. I was so blown away by the whole thing that I didn't even think about looking for Tyson. I was so spaced out by it that I didn't even realize until lunch that I was the prime suspect. I didn't do it. I screamed into Mr. Green's face. I'd never screamed into a teacher's face before, but now I couldn't control myself. It was sixth period, just after lunch, and Green had me called out of class to go to his office so he could accuse me of planting those rocks for Austin to fall on. I don't believe you, he said, standing in front of his desk. I swear I didn't. Oh, then it was just a coincidence that you were there when it happened. Right. And it was just a coincidence that you had a big fight with Austin yesterday? It wasn't big. A 156D, and I suppose you're going to tell me you and your club had nothing to do with Ferris Bike, or David's Trumpet, or Drew's Fish Tanker, right? Come off it, Jared. He pounded his desk. He was so sure he was right, it scared me. It took me a while, but I found out exactly who's in your club. And you know what? Everyone in your club has a grudge against the very people who have been victims of this terrorism. That's right, I said, we're being framed. Framed? By whom? By Tyson McGaw. Green wasn't ready for that. It took a few seconds for it to sink in, then he said, if you think you're going to foist the blame on Tyson. But it's true. Tyson wouldn't do that, I know he wouldn't. But we have a witness, I said. Who? Ralphie Sherman. He saw Tyson blow up the fish tank. Yeah? Said Green. Ralphie Sherman also says that his mother had puppies. Do you expect me to believe a thing Ralphie Sherman says? It's the truth. Why don't you bring Tyson in here and accuse him like you're accusing me? Because, said Green, with nasty sarcasm in his voice, Tyson didn't come to school today, Jared. Last I heard, he was TFCE victim, a 157A, being terrorized by a kid who beat him up and chased him out of school yesterday, screaming bedwetter at the top of his lungs. Any idea who Matt was, Jared? He looked at me as if I were a criminal. You know, lots of people have spent years helping Tyson overcome a miserable childhood, and what you've done may have destroyed everything we've done to help him. Green gave me the evil eye for just a moment longer, then he sat down, pulled a gold pen out of his shirt, and began to write. I want you to take this note to your seventh period teacher. It will excuse you from class. I'm also giving you a list of the classrooms in which each member of the Shadow Club can be found during seventh period. I want you to get them all out of class and bring them to my office so we can settle this once and for all. He handed me the note, just as the bell for seventh period rang. And I think a talk with all of your parents tomorrow is in order as well. I turned to leave. You have 10 minutes. I'll be waiting for all of you. If you don't show, you'll be in even deeper trouble. Don't worry, I said. You can trust me. Can I? Of course. 10 minutes later, the Shadow Club was nowhere to be found. Green must have scoured the school for us, but he didn't find us and wouldn't find us that day. N158O, this was war now, and if we were going to prove our innocence, we had to treat it like a war. As soon as I had gotten everyone out of class, we split up and snuck out of school, all to meet in 20 minutes at Stonehenge. Green seemed to know an awful lot, and if he knew where Stonehenge was, then we'd all be in for it, so we just had to hope he didn't know. Although it was cold and windy, with thick clouds blowing across the sky, for once my hands weren't cold. They were hot with anger. Anger at Tyson McGaw. If I never did anything else as president of the Shadow Club, I was going to make Tyson pay for what he had done.